Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. You can find us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. My name is Joe Epstein. I'm a past president of the Commonwealth Club's Board of Governors, and I'll be your moderator for this evening. It is my pleasure to welcome tonight's speaker, Robert Reich, former Secretary of Labor. Robert Reich has spent his life fighting for working people and their families. He has served in three presidential administrations, and most recently as the Secretary of Labor under President Clinton. That administration managed the longest economic expansion in history, and it created more than 22 million jobs nationwide. As the Secretary of Labor, Robert Reich implemented the Family and Medical Leave Act. He led a national fight against sweatshops in the U.S. and illegal child labor around the world. He headed the administration's successful effort to raise the minimum wage to secure workers' pensions. He also launched job training programs, one-stop career centers, and school-to-work initiatives. Currently, Professor Reich teaches at the Goldman School of Public Policy at the University of California, Berkeley. His commentary on America's economic climate can be heard weekly on public radio's Marketplace. Robert Reich is also the author of multiple bestsellers, including The Future of Success, Locked in the Cabinet, and his most recent book, Supercapitalism. Robert Reich was a Rhodes Scholar at Oxford while earning his master's degree, and in 2003 was awarded the prestigious Vaclav Havel Vision Foundation Prize for his pioneering work in economic and social thought. He received his Juris Doctorate from Yale Law School in 1973. In these unusual times, all of us are looking for some good news. And I'm not going to promise this to you, but what I will promise is that when you leave this auditorium tonight, you will at least have the satisfaction that you have heard from a man who, as much as anyone in this country, understands how America's financial climate has become so uncertain and what the prospects for recovery lie ahead. So please welcome tonight's guest, former Secretary of Labor in the Clinton administration, Robert Reich.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much. And thank you, Joe, for that great introduction. I also want to thank Rosalind Warren, a recent Cal graduate, who put all this together. Thank you, Rosalind. Well, by the time you who may be listening to this on the radio know what has happened since the Senate and the House approved the bailout bill, you will know much more than we do tonight, sitting here in Lafayette, California. But let me just give you a sense of what has happened and why it has happened. Actually, it's probably more important to know why things have got to where they are right now, rather than the political intricacies of what's going to happen over the next couple of days, and then also talk to you about what the consequences are likely to be for what's happened, not only with regard to the economic and financial consequences, but also the consequences for the next president, whoever that next president may be. First, how did we get into this? Why are we into a financial bind of this sort? I don't remember so many Americans so angry about a potential meltdown of Wall Street, so angry that there's been almost a process of extortion whereby, at least in the public's mind, the public and average taxpayers are being asked to take on risks and thereby indirectly maintain their earnings of many people on Wall Street whose malfeasance, nonfeasance, cupidity, greed, and stupidity got us into this mess, not to put too fine a point on it. It's not that easy, and it's not that simple, and the villains are not that easily identifiable. But one culprit, certainly, was Alan Greenspan, because Alan Greenspan, in 2003, 2004, engineered a reduction of short-term interest rates, federal funds rate, down to 1%. And that fairly predictably unleashed a torrent of money. Money became extraordinarily cheap in the United States. And that fairly predictably generated a great deal of desire on the part of lenders to get the money out the door as fast as they could into the hands of anybody who would take it and borrow it, whether they could stand up straight or not, whether they were qualified or not. Now, according to some observers, the problem here, and indeed the culprit, is all these people who had no right getting loans in the first place. But if you're talking about moral hazard, that is, you're talking about who should have known and who is likely, on the basis of this bailout, to take risks in the future that they should have known were risks, it really isn't all that many homeowners who took on these loans, because most of them didn't really know very much. Many of them were first-time homeowners. Many of them were relatively poor. Many of them were easily persuaded that no interest down and no down deposit and free money and what looked like basically a free house was a pretty good deal. No, the people who should have known what they were doing was people who had experience lending money. And I think they did know what they were doing. Indeed, the problem here is that there was very little oversight of the people who were doing all the lending. When money became so cheap, when Alan Greenspan and company got it down to 1%, which, if you figure in inflation, is actually a negative cost of money, alarms should have gone off all over the federal government and at the Fed that some more rigorous oversight of lending institutions and the lending processes should now commence. But Alan Greenspan said no. He didn't want it, didn't think it was necessary. The Comptroller of the Currency said no, didn't think more regulations or at least more rigorous oversight of the regulations in place was necessary. The Treasury Department didn't think it was necessary. Most of the Bush administration said it was not necessary. And so when you have that combination of easy money and no lending standards and greed, and by the way, greed, I won't say greed is good like Gordon Gekko. I will say, though, that greed is almost inevitable. I mean, you take away greed from Wall Street and what do you get? You have pavement. I mean, the entire economic system depends to a large extent on acquisitiveness and greed and opportunity seeking. And so it's not surprising that if you have very cheap money and you have almost no oversight and very few regulations governing the lending standards, then greed is going to take over and greed is going to get us in a boatload of trouble. And so we got to the point where there was so much bad debt, securitized, bad debt multiplied by complex financial derivatives, the values of which a lot of people didn't even know. I remember 2 years ago, I asked a hedge fund manager, please explain to me what's in your hedge fund. Just explain to me the portfolio. I'm interested. I want to learn. And he laughed and said, I have no idea. Well, I don't know whether he was representative, but I heard the same thing from more than one Wall Street executive. I don't know exactly what we are doing. There's some fancy mathematical models based on a set of fancy assumptions, and it seems to work. Well, the problem is one of the assumptions behind all of those fancy models, one of the assumptions behind all of this was that housing prices would continue to rise because housing prices had risen for so many years. But you get one assumption wrong, and all of those models are worth nothing. In fact, they become quite dangerous. And add that, layer that on top of this unfettered, unregulated, unmonitored process of getting cheap money out the door, and you have a very combustible combination. So combustible that it was almost inevitable. There were many people warning of this. If you, let me say without any humility, look at some of the things I was even writing a couple of years ago, you will see some of these warnings. You don't have to be, and didn't have to be, a rocket scientist to see how combustible this mixture was. You are almost inevitably going to have a very dangerous situation in which a lot of almost worthless pieces of paper come falling down on each other. A situation in which, to use a metaphor, the emperor has no clothes. As the housing bubble burst, it was almost inevitable that all of this would come crashing down. Now, here's the problem. If it were just a matter of Wall Street banks coming down and crashing and investors in Wall Street losing their shirts, well, that would be bad enough. Maybe, says a lot of the public, they deserve it. But the problem is more complicated because credit markets affect all of us. And if credit markets become any more frozen than they already are, and they're pretty frozen right now, because everybody's frightened. Every lender in the entire system is frightened. Why should I, says every lender, an institution, an individual, whoever they are, why should I lend into this system, this financial system, when I have absolutely no confidence that I'm going to get anything back? There's no trust. And if everybody feels that way, then credit markets freeze. And if credit markets freeze, then you can't get any credit. You cannot borrow for your child's education. You can't borrow for a car. You can't get any mortgage, even if you're a good credit risk. Doesn't matter what kind of credit risk you are. Small businesses can't get money. Large businesses can't get money. The entire economy grinds potentially to a halt. You see, if you follow my logic, it's not really a solvency crisis and it's not really a liquidity crisis. It's a crisis of trust. And the crisis of trust is brought on by years in which nobody paid attention. Regulators, people in the market, everybody making a lot of money, nobody felt it necessary to pay attention. So the question really here is, how do you rebuild trust? An infusion of $700 billion or $1 trillion or whatever it's going to be will provide some confidence for some time, because every lender and everybody involved in the market will say, well, there's a lot of money there, and certainly the federal government is willing to do something big. But you're not going to rebuild trust in the system until you have a set of smart regulations that require full disclosure and adequate capital requirements and avoid conflicts of interest, like credit rating agencies paid by the very issuers who they are rating. And also you do something about the compensation of people on Wall Street that is geared so much to the short term that they don't worry about taking big risks with other people's money because they get all of the gains on the upside. And now that we've socialized downside risks, the possibility is of even greater risks on the upside. Now, Hank Paulson is an interesting man. He actually went to college with me. He was in my class. We graduated together. I didn't know him very well. He was a football player. I assume football players cannot be very bright. I was wrong. But Hank Paulson made some of the worst political mistakes that you can possibly imagine. I award him the President James Buchanan Award for Political Stupidity that I give out every year about this time. Actually, I never have. This is the first year I've given it out. Because, you see, by going to Congress and saying, we have an emergency, and I, Treasury Secretary Paulson, I would like a fait accompli. I want a blank check. I want you to just give me $700 billion, no questions asked. And by the way, I know I am part of an administration that has no credibility left at all. And by the way, I do know that the last time this administration asked for a complete blank check, we went to war and 4,000 American lives were lost and countless Iraqi lives have been lost, and it was for no purpose whatsoever because there were no weapons of mass destruction and al-Qaeda really did not have anything to do with Saddam Hussein. But nonetheless, oh, and also I do know that you know that I, Hank Paulson, I was chair of Goldman Sachs for many years. I basically, my entire adult life, I've been on the street. And so, to a large extent, some of the problems that have arisen arose under my watch, or I should have anticipated them, certainly. But nevertheless, give me $700 billion with no questions asked. Well, you're not going to get a great deal of cooperation. Worse, even if you are negotiating, even if you are using that as an opening gambit for a negotiation in terms of what you really want or what you think you're going to end up with, what you fail to understand in politics is that you're not just negotiating with Congress, you're negotiating with the American people. And by using that as an opening gambit, you aggravate every possible fear and indeed paranoid tendency in the American public about Wall Street and about what those people have been up to. How can we possibly trust them? Now, Americans still don't trust this bailout deal. Most of the polls show that most Americans are furious about it. And the level of trust toward government and toward Wall Street is at an all-time low. In fact, I don't remember a time when Wall Street, as a set of institutions and people, rated that much lower in public esteem, lower even than Congress. Politics comes from the Greek root poly, meaning many, and ticks, small blood-sucking insects. No, I don't really mean that. I had the privilege of being in politics almost half my adult life. But Wall Street has the additional distinction, or in the public's mind, problem, of being the source of so much money for so many people, or actually proportionally so few people. That is, we're talking about people who quite egregiously and openly and conspicuously were taking home 7, 8, 9-digit compensation packages at exactly the same time that most Americans were seeing their own incomes actually declining. Today, the median income in the United States is lower than it was in 2000, adjusted for inflation. The typical 30-year-old male in the United States today is earning, again, adjusted for inflation, 12% below what the typical 30-year-old male was earning 30 years ago. Americans are struggling. Not only fuel and food prices, but also, as all of you know, health insurance and the cost of sending a kid to college and everything else. And the gap between the top 1% and everybody else is growing into a chasm. The bailout will not ultimately do much It will provide a one-shot of confidence. It will stop the bleeding, but it will not end the underlying problem. The next president will have an economic problem on his hands. It's more than a crisis of confidence. It's a much bigger economic problem. Now, some people say, with a $700 billion bailout, how is it going to be possible for the next president to deliver on the next president's agenda? If it's President John McCain, how will it be possible for John McCain to deliver on his tax cuts, mostly for the wealthy? If it's President Barack Obama, how is it going to be possible for Barack Obama to deliver on his affordable health care or his education or his energy and infrastructure plans? Now, I was in the Clinton administration. I had the great honor of being asked by Bill Clinton in the fall of 1992, right after he won, to handle his economic transition and run his economic transition team. At that time, I was a professor at Harvard. I had just finished teaching a class. He called me. I knew him from before. I said, "Bill, congratulations." He said, "Thank you, Bob." I said, "Should I call you Mr. President or President-elect?" He said, no. At least now, call me Bill. Bob, he said, "Could you please come down to Washington and just figure out, you know, how much we owe?" I said, "Sure, that doesn't sound like too difficult a job. I'll just come down and figure out how much we owe." And I went down, and it was hard because it turned out we as Americans, in terms of the budget deficit, we owed more than we thought we owed, or at least more than the first Bush administration had told us that we owed. We actually owed about $300 billion a year, as far as the eye could see, which may not sound like much by today's standards, because today's budget deficit is about $410 billion. At least that's the projection for fiscal year 2009. But as a proportion of the economy, $300 billion was much larger. It was getting on about 5% of the whole national economy. And that was too large. And given that we were coming out of a recession, it was enough to worry the Federal Reserve Board. And Alan Greenspan made it very clear, couldn't have made it clearer, that if we didn't do something about that budget deficit, he was not going to reduce interest rates, and we were not going to have a very buoyant economic recovery. And by the way, sotto voce, "Mr. President, you want to be reelected? You better have a buoyant economic recovery." And so we had not much choice. We had to pare back dramatically Bill Clinton's promises and his agenda that he developed in the 1992 campaign. Well, is history about to repeat itself? Not necessarily. Reason number one is this: the $700 billion bailout is not technically an expenditure. Here's what's going to happen. The Treasury is going to the extent any more money is needed, is going to borrow it. And the borrowing is going to come primarily, I assume, from Asians. That's where most of the borrowing has come, and from the Middle East. After all, the Chinese and the Middle Easterners are the ones who have a lot of dollars. And they're looking for where to put their dollars, and they'll put it into Treasury bills. And that's not to say this is not a problem, but I just want to explain to you exactly where the money is going to come from. Now, the United States government, that is the Treasury, is going to take on these bad debts to the extent that Wall Street wants to get rid of them. And there is going to be a little bit of a reverse auction. That is, just like you get when an airline is overbooked, The airline says, well, we'll give you $100. Not get enough people. We'll give you 200. Maybe we'll give you a round trip. We'll give you two round trips, up to the point where you get what you need. Well, a reverse auction can also work and will work, I assume, with these bad debts because nobody knows what they're worth. There's no market for them. And so a reverse auction will occur, and the United States Treasury will say, well, here's an amount of money, and who is willing to give us, that is the government, that is the Treasury, your bad debts, and we will try to minimize the cost, and you will get the bad debts off the book, you'll get some cash. But presumably, at some point in the future, housing prices will start turning up again. We don't know when. It may be a year, it may be 2 years, some people say 5 years. But when housing prices start going up again, some of those mortgage-backed securities will presumably be worth a little bit more than they are now. And when they are worth more than they are now, presumably, and this is all a matter of a lot of assumptions, the Treasury can sell them off and get its money, that is your money, that is our borrowing money, back. In fact, some people say the Treasury might even make some money. Maybe it's a good deal. My point with you only for the purpose of this analysis is that we shouldn't think of that $700 billion as if it were taken right out of the capacity of the next administration to do a variety of things. It's not that direct. Number two, unlike 1993, when the economy was coming out of a recession and factory orders were going up, and unemployment was just beginning to go up, and investment was just beginning to increase. Right now, we are going into a recession. I hate to tell you this because you look like nice people and you look friendly and you look pretty happy, or you did when I started to talk. 2009 is likely to be a very hard year. Bailout or no bailout. Now, when you go into a deep recession, that means that there is a lot of capacity that is not being utilized in the economy. A lot of people unemployed, a lot of factories idle, a lot of office space not being used. Now, when you have a lot of extra capacity, what do you need? Well, you need two things. You need monetary policy, that is, you need the Fed to reduce interest rates, but there's a limit to how far the Fed can go in reducing interest rates. And then you also need a stimulus by government. We learned this back painfully in the 1930s, because Franklin D. Roosevelt was facing the mother of all depressions in terms of excessive capacity in the economy and didn't know how to do it and didn't know how to get out of it, and he met John Maynard Keynes. They had a meeting, Franklin D. Roosevelt and John Maynard Keynes. I don't know how many of you know about this, but neither of them was very impressed. Keynes didn't understand Roosevelt. Roosevelt thought Keynes was a little bit of a fool or a kook. But what Roosevelt ultimately understood was that the only way to actually get out of the Depression, to fully utilize our capacity, was through government spending, even though that meant deeper debts. My father, a lifelong Republican, always told me when I was a kid that I and my children and my children's children and my children's children's children will be paying the debts from Franklin D. Roosevelt. Well, that proved not to be true. Because by spending, when you have excessive capacity, you actually lift the whole economy. And you reduce the deficit and the debt as a percentage of total economy. And by the way, just to finish the circle, I am possibly hours away from my first grandchild. Easy. I didn't do anything. Well, I did a while ago. But my point with you is that if we're heading into a deep recession, deficit spending is not only appropriate, it may be necessary. Third and final point, and then I'll get to your questions. Not all deficits are equal. You all know this. If you borrow money to send a child to college, that's one thing. If you borrow money to take an ocean cruise, that's a different thing. One is an investment in the future productivity of your kid. The other is kind of a nice thing to do, but at the end of it, you don't have anything to show for it except a bill. Now, if the federal government spends money on education, on roads and bridges and rapid transit, on public health, on healthcare, on the environment, on all the ways in which we actually help ourselves become more productive, that is a kind of investment that is not necessarily a bad thing, even if we've got to go into debt to do it, because it grows the economy. Bottom up. There's a different way of viewing economic growth from the top-down kind of trickle-down theory that we've had since the 1980s. That theory held that if you give people at the top big tax breaks, then they will work harder and they will save more and there will be more money left for investment, and that will help create jobs. The problem with that theory is that in a global economy, it's not trickle-down, it's trickle-out to anywhere around the world where people can get the highest return on their investments. So the real question is, how do we in the United States create an environment in which global capital will come here in order to create good jobs? And the only way global capital will come here to create good jobs is if we invest in our people. Not trickle down, bottom up. And I don't want to make this in any way, shape, or form a partisan discussion, because I know a lot of you, or some of you, or maybe one or two of you may be Republicans. And I want you to know, if you are a Republican, I respect you. I don't like you, but I respect you. No, that's not true. I like you, and I respect you. And indeed, one of the problems in this country is that we really don't have enough of a civil discourse across the ideological and party divide that now divides us. But my only point with you is that there really are different philosophies. And I think whether you are Republican or Democrat, liberal or conservative, you can see the logic of bottom-up economics, of building our workforce, building our infrastructure, building our capacity to be more productive. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is really ultimately what this is all about. The bailout package, the crisis on Wall Street, is getting a lot of headlines. It is causing an awful lot of sleepless nights for a lot of people. If you are heading into retirement, or if you are in retirement, you're mighty worried, and I don't blame you. Anybody who's over 60 should be very worried. That includes me. But in the great scheme of things, the bailout is not going to cure the economy, and it also is not really the most important issue facing us. And on that upbeat note, let me end and thank you for your attention. And I look forward to your questions.
Our thanks to Robert Reich for his comments today. As I said, Robert Reich is a professor of public policy at the Goldman School of Public Policy at UC Berkeley. Professor Reich, as you can see, we have a great number of questions here. And to start off with, I would love to give you an opportunity to plug your book, Supercapitalism. So let me ask this question. When did corporations gain power and citizens start to lose their rights and their influence? When did the social contract start to collapse?
In 1978, March 12th. Your next question? The theme of the book is that we are all simultaneously consumers and investors and also citizens. And as consumers and investors over the last 30 years, we've been doing pretty well. I mean, as investors, we've hit a hiccup. But as consumers and investors, if you look over the last 30 years, we have done very well. Because increasing competition in the market has intensified the incentives on every corporation to do better, to deliver more for investors and for consumers, at peril of losing consumers and investors. The problem is that same intensifying competition has also spilled over into the political arena. And every major corporation now has a platoon of lawyers and lobbyists and public relations professionals in Washington, usually fighting other platoons of lawyers, lobbyists, and public relations professionals representing other companies or other industries. And so as citizens, we have less and less of a say, even though as consumers and investors, we have more and more say. So I don't want to give away the whole plot, but I'm going to say just one more thing, and that is that in the future, the big choice in terms of the evolution of capitalism is between democratic capitalism and authoritarian capitalism. China and Singapore offer us authoritarian capitalism. That is, economic rights that are becoming increasingly transparent, but no political or civil rights. And the question from a standpoint of the development of the world economy and also the development and fulfillment of human beings is whether we can make democratic capitalism work.
There are apparently several people in the audience, maybe many people who are in, hopefully still gainfully employed in the financial services industry, and there are some really good questions here, but I happen to have written one last night that I thought would be a sort of a good opening question. So I'm going to try to fold those into one fairly long question. And actually, here's how it goes. When Lehman Brothers filed for bankruptcy recently, I called my next door neighbor. He worked for Lehman, and I called him to console him. Now, I never quite knew exactly what his role at Lehman was, but he told me it was his group that was the cause of the problem in the financial markets. His specialty, he said, were mortgage and asset-backed securities, and that's what these questions are really about. So, Professor Reich, please explain, if you would please, what these symbols mean. For example, SDOs, securitized debt obligations, CDOs, collateralized debt obligations, and CDS, credit default swaps.
Well, if I knew.
If you don't, we're in trouble.
No, I can tell you, and I can actually explain some of those things, including a lot more, but many of them are what we would call either derivatives, that is, they are derived from the underlying values of the mortgage-backed securities, or they are insurance vehicles to somehow hedge the bets so that if a bet goes wrong, you can somehow still collect some money. Now, the securitization and the derivatives and the insurance operations all got very, very intricate and very complicated and very clever. And those of you who are in the Wall Street or were in the Wall Street financial services industry, I don't want to blame you. You're good people. You're not even misguided. You were just simply doing what you thought was necessary to do, and hopefully you made a lot of money. The problem is, as is so often the case, this is not a matter of individual malevolence or nonfeasance or malfeasance. It's usually a system that is out of control, either because, as we saw, people find ways of making money and then other people imitate them and there is insufficient regulation, insufficient oversight, or because money as it was is so cheap that everybody has incentives to operate in particular ways, or because people are paid in ways that generate a certain kind of incentive so that the system kind of gets out of whack. And that is, in fact, what has happened.
Why does the United States like to privatize profits and socialize losses?
We certainly privatize profits with regard to very large institutions and also with regard to relatively wealthy investors. And we socialized the losses partly because those very large institutions and very wealthy investors aggregate a great deal of political power, and or because those very large institutions and very wealthy investors or participants have a lot of economic power and therefore can directly or indirectly affect a lot of other people's lives in some potentially negative ways. When Hank Paulson talks about a firm being too big to fail, one thing you ought to ask yourself as a citizen is, why did they get too big to fail? How did they get too big to fail? Why are there firms that are privately owned and run that are too big to fail? How can we really get along with capitalism on the upside and socialism on the downside? Because if we keep on doing that, as we have done, and by the way, we've done it for many years. I thought we learned our lesson after the savings and loan debacle of the late 1980s. You remember when we basically socialized the risk. We had a government guarantee for those savings and loan institutions, and so there was, in effect, a moral hazard. All of those savings and loan officers, they had every incentive to take on some very risky bets. And then the thing fell apart. And we also had junk bond scandals. Remember the 1980s and insider trading? I thought that that whole era, the era of the masters of the universe, would have taught us something. And then I thought, in my own naivete, that in 2001, 2002, 2003, when we went through Enron and WorldCom and all of the looting of corporations, we would have, again, learned something. You see, it's not just a matter of regulation. It's a matter of smart regulation. Personally, I believe that after WorldCom and Enron and Adelphia and all of those, we overregulated in some stupid ways. We went into Sarbanes-Oxley and sort of with a big sledgehammer. But the public, when the public gets scared and angry, the public is going to react, and it wants big sledgehammers. So instead of catapulting back and forth from these scandals to sledgehammers and back to scandals and back to new regulatory sledgehammers, why is it so difficult for us? And I offer this to you as a rhetorical question in a way that I would love to have your you know, it's not that I have an answer, but it is a kind of broad-based question that I hope our society begins to answer for itself. Why is it so hard for us to learn any practical lessons?
Well, the term that we're all familiar with now is Wall Street versus Main Street. It's being used by analysts, journalists, politicians. We have several questions here, and I'm going to ask the one that I think best states the case. I would call it a Main Street question. This is not my question. And it goes as follows. What if people with foreclosed mortgages or mortgages that were in danger of foreclosure could renegotiate their mortgages into 30-year fixed at, say, 5% based on the current depreciated market price less their equity? This would enable them to remain in their neighborhoods, in their towns, and in their schools. Is this a viable alternative to the current bailout plan?
Well, months ago, many people were urging that there be some sort of easy bankruptcy process for people to renegotiate if they could not pay their mortgage loans, on the theory that it would be better for everybody, including the lenders, to have somebody in the houses paying what they could pay than empty houses and no payments, bringing down neighborhood values all around them. And that still seems pretty logical to me. Now, some mortgage lenders said, no, we don't want to do that because if we allow people to renegotiate, then these mortgage loans are going to be worth even less, and it's going to be even more risky to issue a new mortgage loan. Well, again, it doesn't make much sense to me because right now we've got empty houses and nobody is gaining from those empty houses. And neighborhood values are suffering. Now, this procedure, some sort of quasi-bankruptcy procedure, some sort of reorganization procedure, was supposed to be in the big bailout bill. It never made it. All that's there in the bailout bill for homeowners is a provision, the last time I looked, that allowed the Secretary of the Treasury, in the Secretary of the Treasury's discretion, to help distress some homeowners. Well, that's like returning it to the circular file.
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California's radio program. Robert Reich, former Secretary of Labor and professor at the Goldman School of Public Policy at UC Berkeley, is here discussing the economic crisis and what's at stake in the coming election. So there are questions about the election that will be coming up. My name is Joe Epstein. Professor Reich, what does your crystal ball say the final cost might be if there is a bailout?
If everything goes very well, if housing prices do start turning around over the next year or two or three, if the Treasury handles these reverse auctions appropriately, or on the other hand, if the Treasury is actually going to provide recapitalization, a direct cash infusion into these banks and gets some stock back, some warrants, some actually shares of stock, some equity interest, well, if everything goes as one would hope, then the ultimate cost could be zero. How many of you, out of curiosity, believe that the ultimate cost will be zero? How many of you, honestly, believe that the federal government, the Treasury, will come out ahead? Six of you. How many of you think that this will end up costing the government a great deal of money? 140 of you. Well, the fact is nobody knows. Absolutely nobody knows. This is a risky proposition because nobody knows what the value of these mortgage-backed securities are, the values are. I mean, this is like the Treasury buying up paper for which there is no market, attempting to create a market while it buys the paper up. Do you understand the slight circularity in that process?
Well, Professor Reich, we know there's opposition to the bailout plan. Could you please analyze the opportunities to the proposed $700 billion rescue package? Do you think congressmen and women are mostly afraid of the anger of their constituents, or are there valid other ways of going about the rescue of the economy? And might I just add something else? It appears that there is something that resembles earmarks now going onto the bailout plane, favors for certain congresspeople for their districts in order to get this plan passed. Is that correct?
No. The Senate did tack on some tax provisions, either to extend some tax credits that are very popular or to provide a patch, a kind of one-year patch, onto the alternative minimum tax so it doesn't hit the middle class as hard as it would otherwise hit the middle class. And then there's another provision the Senate tacked on when I last looked, which would provide parity for health insurance, both to people who are sick and needing health insurance, but also to the mentally disabled. Now, these provisions I don't find terribly objectionable, but I do find objectionable tacking on any provisions to a bill that really ought to be as clean as possible, given where we are right now and given how scared everybody is. I would expect that these provisions will be eliminated. Now, again, anybody who's listening on the radio maybe weeks hence will know whether I'm right. But I do believe that the House is going to be required, because the Rules Committee is already requiring it, a clean bill, no amendments. And when that goes to conference, I would expect that all of those other provisions are going to be ripped out of it. Now, Joe, your question, Were there other ways of doing this? Yes. Were there better ways of doing this? Undoubtedly. But is that relevant right now? No. The public is very unhappy. Let me be clear with you about something. The polls, to the extent that you can believe polls, and I think that the polls give us a rough view of where people are, the polls show that most Americans were willing to at least go along with the bailout plan, but a vast majority of Americans hated it. Now, is that inconsistent? Not really, because, again, there's a sense of kind of broad-based extortion here. If we've got a choice between a terrible bailout plan, on the one hand, or a 20% probability of an entire financial world meltdown and an economic collapse, which do you take? You take the bad bailout bill. And that's where I think most people are. There is a populist current in America, an anti-angry, anti-establishment current that you must never underestimate. On the left, it's anti-corporate and anti-Wall Street. On the right, it's anti-government and anti-Wall Street. Do you see the overlap? And that populist current, angry populist current, always with us, is being ignited as I have not seen it ignited in years and years. And although this bailout bill goes through, that anger is still very much there. And that anger can be healthy, but it also can be the fodder for demagogues who channel the anger in all kinds of wild directions. The poor, immigrants, the rich, the French.
Well, that's a great lead-in to another question, but I wasn't prepared to ask that question yet, so I'm going to step aside for a second and talk about the real bad boy of this financial environment. It's called executive compensation. It's a few questions, and again, let me put them together. If companies fail, Professor Reich, and CEOs are fired by shareholders, or in the case of Fannie and Freddie, fired by the government, should some of the parachutes, gold parachutes, silver parachutes, or otherwise, be abrogated? Should they be renegotiated downward, or should they be eliminated?
Well, the bailout bill does have provisions to control executive compensation, particularly golden parachutes, particularly under circumstances where the government is getting an equity stake or a quasi-equity stake in these firms. But you're asking a broader question, Joe. And I think you and the audience are much concerned about a broader question. That is, executive compensation, not just on Wall Street, but across the board, seems to have got totally out of control. In 1980, the typical executive of a Fortune 500 company or a big financial institution was earning about 30 times more than the typical American worker. By 1990, that got up to about 120 times. Now it's 250 times. And a lot of people just don't think that's fair. They think something's rotten. I mentioned before inequality. Right now, the top 1% of Americans by income are taking home about 20% of all of national income. Now, that may seem appropriate or not appropriate, but by way of contrast, as recently as 1980, and 1980 wasn't all that long ago, the top 1% was taking home 8% of total national income. In other words, we've seen a huge concentration of income and wealth, even more, in this country over the past 25 or 30 years. The last time we had the top 1% earning anything close to 20% of total national income was the year 1928. And some of you may remember not directly, maybe some of you do remember directly, what happened in 1929. Now, I don't want to draw any false correlations, but I do think that there is a big problem here, and it has to do not only with executive compensation, but all kinds of crazy compensation schemes. And that is that if the middle class does not have enough income, you can't keep the economy going. What happened in the late 1920s, as income concentrated at the top, was that the only way the middle class could actually keep on purchasing was by going deeper and deeper into debt. And believe it or not, there was a housing bubble. And everything came crashing down when that debt mountain came crashing down. Do you see similarities? We tend to view the issue of inequality as an issue of fairness. We don't understand that the kind of inequality we're now seeing also has a bearing on the functioning of the economy. So executive compensation is going to be a big and important issue. I don't think we ought to pick on just financial executives or just corporate executives. We ought to look across the board. Some people say it's entirely fair that Hollywood celebrities take home as much as they do, or that great sports talents take home as much as they do. Well, why is it fair for them to take home as much as they do and not for very talented executives? Maybe we need a higher marginal income tax on high incomes. Is that a popular position to take? Not particularly. Or maybe we simply need to talk about the responsibilities we have to one another in this society and how we enhance the kind of public investments that I talked about before.
Professor Reich, you talked about deregulation in your prepared remarks. Securities and Exchange Commission Chairman Christopher Cox acknowledges that voluntary supervision of Wall Street's largest investment banks has contributed to the global financial crisis. And there was an article in the New York Times where he was interviewed, and he talked about a 1999 law, which I wasn't familiar with. I hope you are. It's called the Graham-Leach-Bliley Act. Are you familiar with that? And if so, why is that act so significant?
Well, there's been a number of steps have been taken since the 1970s toward financial deregulation. In the late 90s, that particular act basically took down the wall that had existed since the 1930s between commercial banking and investment banking. That old law was the Glass-Steagall Act. And the Clinton administration and my friend Bob Rubin and Alan Greenspan and others joined with Wall Street to take down the wall, thinking that, in fact, there was not going to be no problems. Well, taking down that wall itself did not create problems, but then when you aggregated that with a lot of other deregulatory activities, such as the Securities and Exchange Commission loosening the reins in 2004 on various sorts of trades, and then again, as I said, in 2004, a lack of oversight with regard to easy money, well, the aggregate impact of all of that was to lose an entire regulatory framework for the financial industry, and that in turn contributing to an anything-goes atmosphere.
You mentioned earlier that the money for the bailout plan might come from Asian and Middle East sources, amongst others. What other nations are working on solutions for their own problems? How about Britain, particularly? How about other allies of ours in Western Europe?
Well, because we have a global capital market, and because so many of those bad loans, particularly mortgage-backed securities, were wrapped up in securities that were then sold all around the world, this problem is not solely a U.S. problem. The U.S. is leading the way toward perhaps a solution, or perhaps the appearance of a solution, and the rest of the world is looking with great trepidation and hope with regard to what we are doing. But I can tell you, everywhere around the world, these issues are cropping up. Now, other governments are probably going to do something that we have also done, and that is create a lot of money, create a lot of liquidity. Central banks around the world are at this moment coordinating with our central bank and pushing more and more money into the system. So again, it is not a liquidity crisis. But as I said before, it really is not fundamentally a crisis of solvency or liquidity. It's fundamentally a crisis of confidence and trust. So what we need is other governments are going to have to make their capital markets as transparent as possible, as quickly as possible. You know, one of the great ironies here is that for years the United States has been telling developing nations, the way you get and attract global capital is if you make your financial markets transparent. Well, there is a pot calling the kettle issue. And I think a lot of developing nations may be saying to themselves under their breath, look who's talking. By the way, just back on executive pay, part of your question, Joe, a moment ago, had to do with golden parachutes and great awards for executives who actually lost money. One executive comes to mind just randomly is Carly Fiorina and Hewlett-Packard and getting $42 million after having been essentially fired. She's advising one of the candidates, isn't she?
I believe she
anyway,
is, yes.
Not to dwell on that, but I do think that the issue of say in pay, investors having more say over the pay and compensation packages and golden parachutes of top executives is also ripening as an issue because of all of this.
And Professor Reich, I believe you are advising one of the candidates as well.
But I'm not making nearly that kind of money.
But I think
you know,
the
University of California is a wonderful place. No golden parachutes and no fat contracts.
But since you do have an interest, as we all do, in the election, tomorrow night is a very important debate. Could you talk about what you think might happen in this debate? And also, could you give us your candid opinion of the vice presidential candidate, Sarah Palin?
Answer to your second question, no. Answer to your first question, I think that, and again, any listeners 5 weeks from now will know much more than we know now. I can only go by what you have all seen and what I've seen. I don't know how many of you saw the Katie Couric interview. What more can you say? I think that she will probably, that is, Sarah Palin is probably underestimated. I think that in a formal debate situation, when you have 5 minutes or 2 minutes, she's probably very, very good. I know Joe Biden pretty well. He's also extremely good, but he does have a slight potential problem, and I don't mean that he has this problem. It's a potential problem that every once in a while does exhibit itself, and that is he talks a little bit much. But on the other hand, Gwen Ifill, is going to be in charge of keeping the debaters within time. So I think it'll be a very interesting debate, and I don't think there'll be an obvious winner.
I believe you mentioned at the beginning of the program that the Senate did pass the bailout bill. I don't know if you mentioned the numbers. It was 74 to 25. Both Senator Obama and Senator McCain voted in favor of it. So if we can take just a minute or so, or 2 minutes possibly, can you compare some of the highlights between the Democratic and the Republican candidate? I know we can really extend that question or the answer a lot, but we only have a couple of minutes here, and if you can give us some highlights, we'd appreciate it.
Well, I think Senator McCain has a very distinguished record, particularly with regard to courage and bravery during the Vietnam War. Senator Obama is in many ways a world citizen. I mean, he did spend part of his youth in Indonesia. And what excites me about him is not only his intelligence and his passion for the public interest, but also the effect he has on young people. To me, being a teacher, being a college professor, I look to the future And I understand that the future of our democracy is really in the hands of young people who are either going to be turned off of politics or going to get turned on to politics. And I got turned on to politics in 1968 because in 1968, Robert Kennedy was running for president, and Eugene McCarthy was running for president, and the Vietnam War was raging, and I and my generation felt compelled to do something about it, and we were inspired by these people. And Martin Luther King offered inspiration. And to me, I say somebody who can inspire like that and change the way people, young people, feel about politics gets my vote every time.
Thank you. Well, unfortunately, we have run out of time. We have so many more questions, and I want to thank the audience for submitting some really fabulous questions. I'm sorry we didn't have an opportunity to get to all of them. Our thanks to Robert Reich, former Secretary of Labor and professor at the Goldman School of Public Policy at the University of California at Berkeley. We also thank our audiences here and on the radio. My name's Joe Epstein. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating more than a century of enlightened discussion, is adjourned. Thank you very much.